Group meeting, Friday, 3rd July, 1981. In its profoundest sense, does the word effort have any validity in the religious life? Now it's a case of how one approaches the question. Whatsoever has to be done involves effort. We appreciate that very much where physical work has to be done. Well, obviously the effort has to be put into it in order to do it. Or if you are preparing for some special meeting or some special occasion, you have to make an effort about it all. But for living religiously, has effort got to be put into it? And first, perhaps it would be good if we had our minds clear regarding the meaning of religious living. What do we mean by the religious life? The bulk of the world thinks of it in terms of ceremonies, rituals, talks concerned with doctrines and dogmas and so forth, and the expression of certain beliefs and so on. And in a very vague and a general sort of way, living the good life. So what does religious living mean for us? Perhaps we could tie it up with another related question. Why do we turn to religion? Why do we seek the religious life? What makes us do it? Supposing, for instance, we were perfectly content, perfectly happy. There was nothing worrying us, nothing troubling us, nothing to cause us to be anxious or afraid. Would we then strive to live the religious life? That is to strive, meaning make an effort to live it? Or would we live it quite naturally? What do you think?
No, I think it's the pain and suffering and the everyday troubles that you have that I think in the end cause you to turn to the religious life.
Yes, that is so. Those who become serious about religious living, unless they are born with a natural tendency towards religion, but those are very, very few and far between. Such people, you see, are very few and far between. But for the bulk of human beings, it is frustration, failure, sorrow, and anxiety regarding oneself, particularly after death. Question always, what happens to me, you see, arises in the mind, and our upbringing is such throughout all the countries of the world that we turn to religious teachings for the answers, as we call them, you see, and seek to live the religious life. But in attempting to live the religious life, the good life as it is called, the life of the virtuous life, shall we say, in trying deliberately to live the virtuous life, one of the extraordinary things we discover is that time and again we suffer more, and as we would say, undeservedly, for being good. As we call it. Now that is a very subtle point. That's a very subtle point. Also there is the straightforward situation. We turn to the religious life in order to be free of sorrow and suffering and anxiety and fear of the future and so forth. Well, is that the result of the natural, the inborn organic drive for pleasure, for happiness, for security of the stay-put type? Because all growth, remember, all progress in the real sense involves change. If there is no change, there is no growth possible. Provided, of course, that the change is a progressive change, not a regressive change or a fortuitous change. This is a very important point. It has to be progressive. What do we understand by a progressive change? You see how many questions come up out of the one question. What do we understand by a progressive change? Where we as human beings are concerned. Which would straight away lead us into considerations of what constitutes human progress. We talk of human progress, fulfillment, fruition, we use all these words, but what do they actually mean? What sort of change takes place or has to take place so that all these words find right expression in actuality in our lives? In other words, if we have a vision, a true vision of the purpose of our individual existence, our own personal existence, and how that purpose can be fulfilled, can come to fruition, then we shall be progressing in the right way. We will change, we will grow in terms of a progressive change. Heavens, that raises up again all sorts of problems. You see, what is the purpose of our existence?
Is it not the purpose of existence is to attune more favorably towards peace of mind?
Well, peace of mind is a state of being which emerges with certain things which are not so much external things, external influences, as our own inward condition. You see, we the body is ruled, or rather governed by a natural pleasure-pain mechanism, which is necessary for the existence of the body and for its own safety. This pleasure-pain mechanism tells us what to avoid bodily, physically, and what would be good for the body, for the body's existence. Now, with this pleasure-pain mechanism, we select certain things, we reject certain things. All right? But does that bring peace of mind? You see, we are well acquainted with the fact of indulgence in pleasure, self-indulgence and so forth. Deliberately seeking happiness, defined very largely in terms of pleasure. Whether that pleasure is purely physical sensational pleasure, or whether it is cultural pleasure, art, science, philosophy, and all the rest of it, you see. So we indulge ourselves in pleasure. But consider this business of pain, difficulty, sorrow. Do we not also indulge in pain? Mm-hmm. If only indirectly. In the seeking of pleasure, in the seeking of that which will bring us fulfillment as we think, you see, we do so much that brings painful consequences. Take the person who is very, very self-indulgent. Food, drink, sex, and all that sort of thing, you see. Now, what happens in consequence? He experiences pain, terrible pains, ill health, disease, and so forth. So, at some stage or other, before the pain overwhelms him, he is indulging himself in a way which is painful in itself, but leading to pain which he cannot tackle anymore. Take the common phrase, the morning after the night before, having an awful headache and so forth. Well, why did he drink so much the night before to produce this pain the next morning? He indulged in that, knowing that pain will be the consequence.
I think people don't think that it will. I think they just don't foresee it. They just seem to be stupid that way.
Yes, that's perfectly true. It's the sort of stupidity of people which makes them do this. But because of that, there is this nevertheless, there is this indulgence in that which is painful, actually.
I think it's also, in their minds, an escape from something which is even more painful.
Or perplexing.
Yes.
So you see, all sorts of questions crop up in connection with the meaning of the living of the religious life. If we take the derivation of the word religion, the Latin religare, to bind back to relate back to what? The religious and philosophical people of the world have said, to the source from whence we came, to be put into complete and perfect relationship to that. And as you know, Jungian psychology emphasizes that very, very strongly, far more than any of the other accepted psychologies in the Western world anyway. Jung said, if your relationship with God is right, then you can be free of so much suffering, so much wrongdoing, and so forth. Freud talked in terms of the primacy of the sexual drive, the drive which is concerned with the preservation of the species. Grodek had a curious sort of view of things altogether. He was considerably Freudian, but he had something which he propounded as the id, id, and the id was the sort of ego within one which had to be brought to fruition, and so forth. And Adler, of course, emphasized the social aspect. Adler's psychology was built up for the purpose of putting one right in relationship with society, and that would sort of solve our, at least to a considerable degree, our major problems. Now, all of these are useful in this, that, or the other sphere, but they are all very limited. Jung is about the freest of all. But whether that, whether any of them really answer the question, what is the purpose of our existence, is rather doubtful. What is the great difficulty with which we are faced when we ask this question as regards the purpose of our existence? Our greatest difficulty surely is our self-concernedness. The answer has to be something which satisfies me. Now, has it? Has it got to satisfy me? Say, for instance, I am a stupid person, a foolish man. I have lots of evil tendencies. I'm a bad man, really, inside myself. Now, what sort of answer as regards the fulfillment of the purpose of my existence would satisfy me?
Purely material one, I should think.
Yes, we may call it a purely material one. It certainly is not religious or spiritual in any sense. But there we are. This is the great stumbling block. This desire to satisfy oneself. Take a more exalted situation. Your natural-born philosopher, who is concerned with discovering the truth of things and so forth. You see? All right. What is the primary drive in him? This tremendous intellectual urge to find the answers And if he finds the answers, he will be happy. I will be happy thereby. You see? That is first and foremost the impelling force in him. But does that necessarily open one's eyes to truth? You see, the question is, this business of living the religious life is a tremendous question. It just embraces everything. And all the time, the obstructing, the most powerful obstructing power or force is selfness. Then we might make the mistake of saying we must eradicate selfness. How? It can't be done. You can't eradicate any vice or anything like self. You can't eradicate it. What is selfness? This surely turning in upon oneself and regarding life as a process involving our actual situation in the world, involving a process which brings satisfaction to me as such. Then I may extend that and say, oh, but I like to do so and so in order that my family may be well and happy and provided for and so on. Or I may extend it still further and say, serve my society, the society in which I live, the nation to which I belong. Or we might say, to try and fulfill some deep purpose which is related fundamentally to goodness or truth or something like that, or beauty. But if one looks sufficiently clear-sightedly, one will see that it is always coming back to oneself. There is a selfness involved in it. Now that selfness is our own psychical energy in an ill state, in a form which is sick. Now it is very difficult to see the sickness. It is perfectly obvious from the matter-of-fact common sense point of view that one has to do what is needful for one's own physical sustenance and existence and for those who are dependent upon one. Things like that are obvious facts. All right. But having seen that, and having and from there seeing that this applies to all people composing the society in which we live, then we have to realize that the problem is not just one's own problem, but the problem of everybody. It's a universal problem. All our problems are universal problems. They have a specific form which is perhaps unique to the individual, but the nature of the problem is a universal thing. We say so-and-so is in sorrow, or so-and-so is in suffering, ill health or whatever it is. But it's not just so and so, it's the whole world. All humanity is involved in it. Now the great thing is to see this. Now what is the meaning of seeing it? When one attends with sufficient intensity, with completeness, you can't have sufficient completeness or insufficient completeness, but with completeness, one attends to it as such and sees the relationship which arises when one's own brain is arguing back or talking back at what one is trying to see purely. When one is fully awake to all that process, then the psychically ill state undergoes a change. It is like a chemical which will dissolve